Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, further capital budgeting considerations. This one is actually not too long. There are just a couple of pieces to it, and it is all in the Excel worksheet, NPV and IRR.xslx. So it's more a matter of motivating it, knowing where to put numbers and all of that. And then after that, we will do quiz six, and when you're finished with that, you're done for the day. Be sure you remember that you not only have to sign in with attendance radar at the beginning, but you're also going to have to sign out up front here and show that you have completed the quiz, confirm that you did finish the quiz so that no one is out. So make sure that you don't have to come back in for attendance. Now, if your attendance isn't working at the first attendance today, be sure you come right up and get it fixed before you start the quiz, because that one is going to be the start of us recognizing that you're here for the quiz. But first, a look at the numbers, and the numbers are really up today, because there is right now a temporary ceasefire in the Middle East, and that just made all the markets just go through the roof. And remember that they are not considering what will come after this. We've had these kinds of, yeah, it's all over now, and then it's just flared right back up. So just as easily as this market can roar back up, it can just crash back down again. And this is true not just of stocks, it's also true of the commodity markets, specifically the oil markets. But right now we have on the east side of the world, we had just a big jump right off the bat on the Nikkei from that big jump in the beginning. It didn't really rise too much after that. There was just that piece of news that made the market lift, but there wasn't more news to keep it going up. Once it has gotten that propellant pushed out of it into the price, well then, unless there's more good news, it'll just stay at this level it was at that one level. So always keep that in mind, that the market isn't going to just keep reacting to a single piece of news. It'll just put it in there, that news, good or bad, and then it will wait for the next thing to make the market move. So you see that in the Nikkei there, it popped, and then it just sort of drifted slowly upward a little bit after that, not much, but it did finish up a staggering 5.30%. That's a hell of a jump on any exchange, that much. And then the Hang Seng, the same thing. See that jump right there at the beginning, right there. It pops up, and then it stays right where it was, because there was just that good news and no more good news. Moving along over to Europe, the same phenomenon. As soon as the market opened, that good news shot in and did its thing, but then there was very little to keep it going up. There was a little bit of trend upward because of other minor good news, but nothing big from there. So you got the CAC 40, the DAX, the Euronext, they all went up, and the Financial Times 100 in London, on the London Exchange, did the same thing. Coming over to our side of the world, you see that the Dow, the same thing. As soon as the market opened and that news was able to impound, as we say, impound in the price, it jumped, and then there wasn't anything more. That was it, and then it just stayed level from there. The S&P, the Dow, was up a good. Interestingly, they were all up about the same, the ones that I look at. The Dow up 2.8%. The S&P 500 up not quite as much, interestingly, about less than 2.5%. And then the NASDAQ was up More than 2.75%, but they all jumped by about the same percentage, plus or minus 30 basis points or more or so. But they all kind of popped by the same amount because it was the same good news that swept through. And so they all jumped, and then they stayed right about where they were after that. And that's a good, these are great for showing that what information does. It just gets into these stocks as soon as it can, as soon as the opening bell rings, and then from there it just stays right on the same at the same place. So there would be no good, no, it wouldn't be useful to buy in right now on that news that happened earlier. It's already been put into the price. It gets in there so fast. You really, well, we can't. Where we are as retail traders, we really can't jump in on that kind of good news because it's already been put in. The orders come from the Wall Street firms and all of that. And so they beat us to it. They jack the price up with all their buying. By the time we can get an order in, it's already over with. The price has already jumped. And that's an unfortunate part of how efficient the markets are and how little our part of the trading environment affects anything. We get to see it after the big boys have gotten their shot at it. Now, coming over here, as I had said, crude and, overall average crude and Brent just dropped. And that was it. The news was that the Strait of Hormuz may open up again. Notice that they're still well above what they were even a few months ago, when they were down there in the $60 and $70 range. They're still way up from that because really there's nothing has fundamentally changed about what's going on with the ability to transport oil through the Strait of Hormuz and out into the open sea, open waters. So, but still, celebrate this because that means the gasoline prices are not going to jump. In fact, they may even ease up a little bit over the next few days. I don't know how much, probably about 10 cents a gallon, but still, it certainly did keep the price of oil from climbing up to $4.50 a gallon, which it was probably going to try to do within a week or so. But now we've got a calm. We'll see how long it lasts. I'm of the opinion that it won't last through next week, but for now, at least we have a little bit of relief. Forgive me here for just a second. Okay. Oh, good. Now, looking here at the sector map should be all, oh, no, energy is actually negative right now. But, you know, that's okay. At least we have almost the whole sector map is either light green or dark green. And that's very good news for investors, except for ones like me who have a bear position right now. We're getting killed, but there you are. It's just one of those things. I'm curious. Remember I showed you on Monday how Wendy's had shot up an incredible amount? I want to show you something, but I'm not going to say it until I see it. Interestingly enough, notice that Wendy's did that huge jump. Let's go look at the five-day. Let's look at the, do I have a five-day? Yeah, there we go. Now, notice something interesting. On when I showed you the five-day, Monday was when that big shot upward went. Now, interestingly enough, notice that buyer's remorse. It slowed, it dropped back down again as profit, basically profit takers. It had gone up, and so they said, okay, that's enough. We're going to collect our winnings and sell out. And so you had that sell-off right there. And oddly enough, though, it had a buy after the sell-off because there were a lot of investors who felt, first of all, well, Wendy's has gone up too much and we're going to take our profits. That dropped it. And then there was this secondary reaction where you have it sells off so hard that then there are bulls who come in and say, hey, the price is back down. We're going to grab some of that. And so that caused a secondary jump. It wasn't as strong as the first jump, obviously. You can see that. But that is not that unusual to have an action up and then sell off. And then it sells off to the point where there are buyers who say, hey, this is my chance to get back in. Let me grab some of it. And that brought it back up again, not clear up to where it had been when that big jump happened I showed you on Monday. But still, you can ride if you're confident that this kind of a thing is going to happen. You can buy and then, you know, just sell out when it happens. If you miss that, what you do is you just wait for it to drop back down, and then you grab some of it because there's probably going to be a secondary upswing in it in a day or two. And this is just essentially bulls and bears. The bulls brought it up. Bears said it's too high. They sell. And then the bulls come back in and say, oh, that's good. It went back down again. So let's buy some more, because the fundamentals of the company say that the price should be higher than it was back before all of this excitement happened. It can happen from time to time. And there are other stocks that can do that too, but one that I wish I could remember. I wanted to show you something in another sector here. I'm trying to remember what the one was that I was trying to, that I wanted to show you. I actually wanted to show it to you on Monday, and I did not get a chance to at that time. And I'm trying to remember what it was that I was let me do something here. What's the name of it? The big healthcare company. Is that the right one? Oh, I know what it is. United Health. This is a company that is controversial. It makes a lot of profit, and a lot of that profit is made by denying claims of from the people who have insurance, healthcare insurance with it. This is a company that it's been more than a year ago, the CEO of the company was murdered on the street by sort of a vigilante sort, but that didn't stop the company. I want you to have a look at it. Notice that it is at a very high level, but it is not really moving any place. Even though the market moved a lot today, this company didn't move much at all. And notice that its beta is indicating that it does not have a strong reaction to the world markets. It has a beta of only 0.41. So it doesn't behave as much as, either on the upside or the downside, as the S&P 500 would. Now, if you look over the year to date, notice that that healthcare company had a very steep drop-off in late January. And it's begun to recover right now. You can see that here at the end. But it took a big hit, and that it's not the only one in the health insurance industry that did take one of those big hits. So the question is, why? And also, what's going on with this company's fundamentals? Is this really a good buy, or is it one of those that you probably might want to stay away from? Well, looking at over the last full year, notice that it actually, if you back out further, this company dropped off about not quite a year ago. It dropped off a very high level. And since then, despite ups and downs that look big when you look at a shorter term, over a longer term period, this company has really not gone anywhere. And the lesson that I wanted to bring up with this is, look here. When I look at, like, let's say the 1 month. You see how you look? It looks like there's, oh, wow, it's jumping. It's going somewhere now. But if you back out further, you'll see, looking at the 1 year, you'll see that that's really this one that we saw recently, this jump back, jump up, really doesn't make much of a difference over this longer period of time. The longer term behavior of this company is showing the stock isn't really going anywhere at all. And that's something to keep in mind. Back your perspective up from the day, the week, the month, and look at it over a longer period of time. And you'll oftentimes see, well, at least quite a lot, you'll see that something that looked big now in a large, longer term context really isn't that big in a company like this. So again, the lesson is just look at the longer run and see if there's really a big thing happening now or not. And in this case, it's or not. And I can show you other ones that have this look exciting in the short run, but really in the longer run, they're not all that spectacular. One that I would show you here is, I'm asking for trouble doing this, but TSLA, Tesla. Now you notice that it has had a steep drop off today. Not really steep, but it's down for the day. If you look over the last, let's say, 1 month, a slight trend downward. See these drop falling tops and declining bottoms. Remember what I said about that. That's not a good sign. Well, let's look over a longer period of time. Let's look over the last year. Okay, over the last year, it did have a rise, but you notice that there's more of a trending fall over a longer period of time. So in this case, what's happening in the very short term is affirming what is happening over a longer term. Now, if we look over the last 5 years, the one thing that's for sure is that it is a really volatile stock. Notice the beta on this stock. The beta is a pretty spectacular 1.91. And that, if you look at this chart, that confirms it. This is extraordinarily volatile with deep troughs and then rises and then drops again. That's the reason that you might not want to be a real fan, aside from the fact that it does have a huge beta. You also have to recognize the fact that this is a company that from 1 month to the next, you could be making a lot of money or you could be losing a lot of money. Now, here's the thing that you have to watch out for. Among amateur traders, they will see a trend behavior like this, and they'll say, well, what I'll do is I'll buy at one of these lows, and then it will go up, and I'll make a lot of money. And then I'll sell when it goes when it gets too high. That's always in retrospect, because when you're down in here, you don't know that the stock is going to go up. You know that in retrospect. And up here, you don't know that the stock is going to go down. Now, I see that it went down, but if you're looking forward in time, you don't know that. So you get this deceptively optimistic idea that, well, I'll just always buy when it's low, and then I'll sell when it's high. But that's not something you really know for the future. It's what you see in retrospect happened, but that's not something that you would have a very good idea was going to happen. Looking forward, the only thing you know looking forward is that that stock price is going to change dramatically, change for the positive or change for the negative. But the only thing you know with some degree of certainty is that it's going to change a lot over a longer period of time. So that's why you want to avoid, in a case like this, just imagining, well, I'll always grab it when it's down there in a low, and then I'll sell it when it's at a high. you don't know that looking forward in time. You know that looking back at what happened, but that's not what's going to happen necessarily. You don't know it what the exact days are that it's going to happen. I'll tell you one of the worst things in the world that traders do. They see this trend upward, and the first thing they're going to do is say, well, I'm going to get in on that. I'm going to buy it because it's going up. Well, when you've got a beta of 1.91, you have a good chance that the day after you buy it, when it's going up, it's going to be taking a drop on the downside. And that's a bad thing. And then the other thing is that if you do grab it in here, you're going to hold on to it. And you're going to think it's going to keep going up. And even when it starts to fall, you're going to say, oh, that's temporary because it's been going up. And then you're going to hold it too long, and then you're going to end up with it down in the dirt again, and you didn't sell it before it got down there. So if you're going to do something like a stock like this, you might as well just buy it and hold it and just not even look at it for a long period of time, because it's going to go gyrating, and you're going to get scared, and you're going to bail. Especially you're going to bail if it drops like this. You're going to dump it, and then it's going to rise again. We see that over and over again with retail traders, that they get caught in this trap where they're always buying when it's about at its peak, and they're always selling it out at the wrong time. Anyway, enough of that. Let me get to the meat of the matter for the day. I have shown you how you do NPV and IRR, and I hope I've convinced you that it's not that hard to do. But one last thing about net present value and internal rate of return. Net present value and internal rate of return. The problem here is not with NPV. NPV will always give you an answer. If it's negative, you say reject. If it's positive, you say accept. In other words, if the profitability index is above 100%, accept. Below 100%, you reject. At 100%, you just say, we can accept it or reject it. It's going to make no economic profit. Basically, what NPV, the number, the net present value number you get down there at the bottom of Excel is telling you, is economic profit. Now, you may remember this from economics. There is a normal profit, the profit that is due to the factors of production. It does not have anything extra in it. There's no unusual profit. There's no economic profit. If you made $60,000 a year in your first job, you profited, $60,000. But suppose that you could have done something, the best you could have done in any other job is $60,000 a year. Then you have made no economic profit at all. You've made normal profit. But if you managed to, you came to me and you said, I just got a job for $90,000 a year, I'd look at you and say, you? No! But see, because you're making more than you should with your level of education and all that. And that would be economic profit. And that's what NPV is telling you, is that an NPV of zero would say you're making exactly what you should make based upon the factors of production, the market conditions, and all of that. Above that, you're getting something unusual. That's why you should always be suspicious of these people who say, well, this is an NPV of $3,000 or $80,000 or $450,000. You want to ask yourself, how are you doing that? That's an economic profit. That should be absorbed by the competitive entry. Why is it that you're getting that? And usually we can trace back suspiciously high NPVs to overly optimistic free cash flow estimates. They are very common to happen. And there have been some pretty ugly fights in corporations where, like, for example, the marketing division or the operations division will say, well, we've already checked and this is a positive NPV profit. Here are the cash flow estimates that we got. And we in finance have to go back and say, you are living in a dream world if you think you're going to make that much. I will give you an example of this, and I may have already done this one for you, but I'll repeat it here. Years ago, back, about 25 years ago, in our sister city to the east and all of that, and to the east of us, there was a proposal for building a sports arena. It would offer a variety of venues, everything from sports shows to other kinds of entertainment. It was going to be on a big piece of land out on the south side of the city, Bloomington. And at one point, I had sort of an inside look. I was teaching elsewhere here in the city at that time on a temporary basis. And the mayor of the city wanted to present this to all of the business students at that school, show just how incredible this was, get more backing for it, promotion, telling it to the students and showing them the numbers. And so they brought the mayor and her city manager, the finance guy, came and gave a speech in which they were talking about this arena that they were going to build. And one of the things that they played to, the finance guy did, he showed an NPV of the project, the free cash flows that would come from it, and all of that. Well, the first thing that was noticeable in their optimism was their revenues. They said that this arena would be in the city right here of Bloomington. Who am I kidding? Bloomington. And they would have a radius of demographic radius of buyers of tickets to the venues of 60 miles. Now, is anyone familiar enough with this area of the country to know what's within 60 miles of Bloomington? Champaign and what's in Peoria? The Peoria Civic Center. You know what else, aside from the cities within 60 miles, you know what else is in that Bloomington radius? Cows and corn and folks who think it's exciting to go and sit on the porch at night and listen to the crickets. They're not going to pay the money to drive 35, 40 miles to watch something in Bloomington. Their estimates of the revenues were way too high, therefore, that brought up free cash flows. And then they made a critical mistake. And they asked for questions after their little presentation. And everyone, of course, wanted to leave. So they weren't asking questions. So I asked the question, where is this going to be? I guess I see it there. I don't see a cost for the land. And the financial manager said, oh, we own the land. Okay, that's a massive mistake. And I think he knew it was, but he tried to do it anyway. You see, because even, especially if you own the land, then that is an opportunity cost. It's a hidden cost. Because instead of using the land for this, you could sell the land. So by using it for this Coliseum, you were you were actually burning money that could have happened. Opportunity cost is the hidden dynamite in any project, not thinking of all those costs that you're not, money's not coming out of your pocket, but that means that money is not coming into your pocket. And so that's the second critical phase in any looking at the revenue stream. Are you being overly optimistic? And looking at the cost stream, are you ignoring opportunity costs, hidden costs of a project? Like, for example, you, madam, I am the CEO, and I've got this great new project. Well, you're already doing things in the company. So when I move you over to this project, I don't consider that a cost of the project, but it is, because it is your salary that is now being given up on all the things you were doing to do something over here. And that is where you have to start, you know, quietly raising your hand and saying, what about this? Why aren't you recognizing that as a cost of the project? Oh, we already have that? That doesn't matter. It has to be considered a cost of the project. So those two things together are critical. Now, how can I do a little more convincing? Well, that great Colosseum was built, and every year it is bleeding millions of dollars. It turned out it was not a good idea. It was a catastrophe of an idea. And if they had been really rigorous in their NPV analysis, they would have seen that that was a negative NPV project right out of the gates. They would never have built it if they had been realistic about the free cash flows in this kind of diagram that we do, in this kind of table we do here. You have to be serious and realistic. And of course, the incentive of a marketing for a new ad campaign, or the operations people for a new fleet of trucks or whatever, they are going to have incentive to ignore the actual revenues and the actual costs of the project. So I send that to you going forward in your professional careers. Always be cynical. Look at things in the worst light possible. Okay, now, the next thing that I want to bring up here, NPV is solid. And as you can see on that picture there, the NPV profile there is a straight line. There's an NPV. And it will be a straight line. It crosses here at the internal rate of return. This is your discount rate on the horizontal axis. This is your NPV on the vertical axis. Okay. Now, the next thing that I want to talk to you about is the internal rate of return. It has two inherent flaws. The first of them is that an internal rate of return is just a number. You see it there for this project. What have I got for the IRR there? I've got, let me fix this one up. While I'm doing that, do your attendance. Go ahead. And if you have a problem with it, come right up so we can fix that right away. Okay, I've modified these numbers for here. Notice that I have a 2000, this is a positive MPV project that I've done here. It's a five-year, negative 80,000 in the initial investment, 18,000, then 30,000, 35,000, then 14,000, including operations and salvage value at the end, $14,000. So I've used a discount rate of 7%, and I find that I get a positive MPV. Here's the thing, that the internal rate of return is 8.26%. So if I were to draw that profile line here at 8.26%, the net present value switches from positive to negative. Oops. Now, here's how companies use the NPV method. They set a hurdle rate. The hurdle rate the company sets is, let's say, 7%. 7.00%. What that means that if any project, if IRR is greater than that 7%, accept the project. If the internal rate of return is less than 7%, the hurdle rate, you reject the project. So, in other words, if a project came in with an internal rate of return that was, the IRR was below 7%, they would say no. So in this case, the project had an internal rate of return of 8.26%, so they say yes, accept the project. It's as simple as that. You say yes if your internal rate of return is above the company policy hurdle rate. You say no if the internal rate of return is below the company's policy rate. This is very commonly used. The problem is simple. Where did they get their hurdle rate? It is exactly like payback period. They pick a number of years. The hurdle rate is just a subjective, we say. There's no reason underneath it. And a lot of companies will just set their hurdle rate. Some companies, I've seen hurdle rates, we don't accept projects with internal rates of return below 12%. All we want are a project that have these very high internal rates of return. And what that means is that they are saying no to projects that are safe. The higher you set that hurdle rate, the more you'll be rejecting low IRR projects. Low IRR projects are safer, generally speaking. So in a way, they're actually always forcing their company's risk level to be high. Because anytime they have a project that they accept, that would be a project that has an internal rate of return above like 12%, or in this case, 7%. So they're forcing their risk level of the company to continuously being increased. Because if all you're accepting are projects over a certain hurdle rate, then all what you're doing is you are always making your company take on riskier projects. And that is not very good management style, especially for a more mature company, to just keep rejecting safe projects to balance risky projects. So that hurdle rate is very popular. It comes straight out of internal rate of return framework, and it's not a very good idea to do it that way. You're just asking for trouble. Now, one other problem internal rates of return have is that the NPV profile line is a straight line if there is only one change in the free cash flow sign. Do you see how this project I've got here has a one-time switch from negative to positive? And it has one crossing of the x-axis. If it has two changes in signs, let's say that it goes from negative to positive, but at the very end, it switches back to negative because of a costly shutdown, a salvage value, negative salvage value, there would be two crossings. So in other words, with one crossing, the NPV profile, crosses once. If there are two sign changes, it crosses twice. If there are three sign changes, it crosses three times. It comes out of polynomial math theory, the degree of the polynomial kind of stuff. If the sign changes more than once, you have more than one internal rate of return. And despite efforts to try to explain what each of those IRRs would mean, they actually are just spurious. There is no internal rate of return that has a meaning in terms of capital budgeting decision making. It's not worth it to even try to use the basic internal rate of return technique method. What you can do instead, what they did when this issue finally was understood fully a long, long time ago, is they went from internal rate of return to modified internal rate of return, MIRR, where it's a technique where you're taking all the negative cash flows and finding their present value, and taking all the positive cash flows and finding their future value, and then taking that and zeroing out everything between, and then doing the comparing this present value at the end to this present value, this negative amount at the beginning. You don't need to worry too much about that, but what you do need to worry about is that finding the present values of the negatives is going to be discounting at something called the financing rate, because you're going to have to borrow money for those negatives. And finding the future values, you're going to have to use another rate called the reinvestment rate. Because those are positive values, you'll reinvest the money. So the book says use the same one for both of them for most of its problems. But it does. You don't have to. Excel has a function. What you need to do is just put in the values. Negative free cash flows, positive free cash flows, just do them all. And then what you do from there is you say, okay, put in a financing rate and a reinvestment rate, and you use, you notice there, the MIRR function. Now, in this case, I set one up, and you'll see this example in the spreadsheets. You just crank the numbers in, and you'll get a modified internal rate of return. Now the question is, should you take this project on? The answer in this case is no, because your modified internal rate of return of the project, taking everything into consideration, is 5.37%. But you're borrowing money at 6%. So there's not a good incentive to do this, because you're borrowing money at a higher cost than you're making money off the project. Taking everything into consideration, you're using capital, one of your resources, at a higher cost than you're earning from that capital. So in a case like this, the MIRR is below the financing rate, I would reject this project because it doesn't pay for itself. That's MIRR. Now I'm going to close this down. It's time for you to take a test, a quiz, and remember, you have to come up afterwards and show that you finished it. But when you're done with that, that's all I have for you today. I thank you.